Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002 and has been broadcast on Preston, Swindon and St Albans Community Radio. Bristol Community FM's Chair Ali Grant and Manager Pat Hart have, however, suspended Dialect indefinitely due to a nearly 30-minute long excerpt from a speech by Bible scholar Gail Ripplinger. Anyway, this week we have Sam Hill from Harpenden talking about child sexual abuse, as well as Helen and Nick, who've just come back from Palestine, near from Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, just off Queen's Square. Call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But to start with, I'm joined by Sam Hill. Sam, you're from Harpenden. You've come a long way over to Bristol today, sitting in our studio with us. Tell us a bit about why.
Well, I think I've got a duty to explain all the things that are being said by the authorities about conspiracy theories, because I was, I'm a survivor of one, if I can use that word, and I've seen the way that the system operates, and I've got a story to tell, quite an important one, I think.
Okay, so your story... Have people ever accused you of being a conspiracy theorist? What is your story?
They start when if you're in a difficult situation in life and you're unfortunate enough to have suffered abuse or something, you automatically sort of almost have the energy around you changed by people's attitudes, be it your family, be it the state. And very often the aim of people who live in respectable neighbourhoods is to sort of quieten it down and call you a fantasist, which is exactly what's being played out by the authorities.
That's easier than actually dealing with something which is rather nasty in the neighbourhood.
It is.
So tell us, first of all, what happened to you?
Well, I was abused in the small village, actually one where a very senior politician is very prominent, but we won't go into that.
Why not? Why? Who's that?
Because I don't feel I can mention names.
Is this politician connected with this?
I was told there were important people involved, and the person who abused me knew him and had been to his house. He's very prominent. Nothing happens in the area without him knowing.
Is that still the case to this day?
Yes, it is. And the fact that I've heard people say that it's always been hushed up because there are important people involved. I was always told there are important people involved.
Okay, do you have actually any evidence that this politician was involved in?
Not direct evidence, no, but only from a memory of the connection that he had with my family and being the only important person that I knew at the time.
So what happened to you exactly?
Right, I was my grandparents moved to a wealthy neighbourhood, and I lived in a relatively small house in a village a few miles away, and I got to know all the people in this neighbourhood. And one very friendly person, you could say, almost like in Jimmy Savile type of charisma, knew everyone. Helped push me up the cherry tree at the front of their house pretty much after they'd moved in, and befriended me got to know me, and he knew many of my friends. I was asked to go to a children's party to be a helper for his daughter and the local doctor's daughter, who was the same age, only about 10 years younger than me. And I experienced elements of organised abuse, and there were his local friends and people in the neighbourhood were GPs, and one of them was present at this party, gave me a large glass of wine.
So how old were you at that point?
I was 10, 11 at this party, and I just started my private school and had my hair cut short so I can trace exactly the age I was. The doctor started talking to me about, you know, myself, you know, my school and generally, you know, but I just experienced men at the top of the stairs exposing themselves. So it was almost like they were called the Dacre Rooms, and it was a little village hall that they were hiring that was hosting this party, having this party. So, and then I got to know the abuser separately from this, and he would told me that he loved me and he wanted to marry me. And
so, okay, how old were you? How old was he?
He was 19 years older than me.
So how old, yeah, but what age?
I was around 12 when it was going on the most part, and we were riding together, cycling together locally, knew all the same people.
So that's, I mean, okay, so he's in his 30s, you're 12, and he's asking you to marry him?
Yes, he said that. He was mentally ill. He had manic depression, apparently, and was being treated at the Priory Hospital in London. And his wife wanted him to keep earning money in the city because he was one of the top earners in the country, and he didn't want to. And, you know, he felt there was a genuine thing between us. It was almost because he was an Etonian. He treated me like I was like his apprentice in a way. It was something that he felt, you know, he was helping me learn about life, you know, and I was, you know, it was supposed to be sort of a respectable thing and I should be proud and glad about it kind of thing. Very strange.
Okay, so what form did this abuse take then?
Yeah, well, basically, he would. But I think in some ways it was abusive because he would actually be threatening suicide, and I would have to be supportive to him. I found that quite abusive, to be emotionally caring for somebody's needs that much older than me. And then when I go home, I was disrespected, treated like a little girl, a silly little girl, you know, and basically blamed by my family.
So when you say, I mean, was he touching you? Was he?
Yes, yes, he was. Yeah, he was. But I don't want to go into too many details. I mean, it was an on and off relationship that we would see each other for a few months and then not see each other. And it carried on until I was 16.
I mean, the trouble is, of course, people will say, well, it's no problem with children having, you know, friendly relationships with people. Mm-hmm. Outside their family. So what's the problem?
Well, I don't know if my parents thought, because he was respectable, because it had already happened, they just let it continue. They didn't really want me around. I wasn't planned. I didn't have a very caring family. So I don't know. They didn't try to put a stop to it till I was 16. And then it became difficult because I was getting a more force to be reckoned with.
So, I mean, at 16, was this a sexual relationship then?
Yes, it was. Yes.
Okay. This place, the Priory, you mentioned, mm-hmm. Did you go there? What was the connection between you and this? And right. Whereabouts is it?
It's in North London. It's near Barnet. That's actually where his wife came from. I don't know who had the connection to the hospital exactly, but his friends were doctors. And they were involved because when I was taken there, one of the doctors who lived over the road said somebody had to sign as a loco parente in order for me to be taken in.
Now, what does that mean?
It meant that they had, you know, legal power to take me in there to get me treated.
Treated for what?
I was always treated like I was a problem by my family. They created me, made me into a problem because they were also abusive. I told my grandparents that my parents were hitting me, didn't want me, and pretty horrible to me, and they wanted to deny that. And when I started talking about telling the police about the abuse, they wanted it all kept quiet. I was treated as if I was the problem, as if I was a problem child.
Yeah, can you remember going to your parents and saying, look, I'm not happy about the way this guy's treating me? It must have been difficult not to be supported.
But my
it?
Parents wanted, you know, they wanted rid of me. They didn't, they just wanted me to leave. And I've got a letter from my grandmother saying that, you know, my mother was really horrible and nasty, that she'd actually told her when I was 15 she wished I'd had a permanent boyfriend in order that I would just leave home as soon as possible.
Okay, back to the Priory then.
Mm-hmm. Right, well, his wife started getting very nasty, and his brother too, who was actually an abuser himself, and he worked in the church. He was more worried about it than anyone, because David and I were actually planning to move to his second home, and he would give up his job. But everybody else was conspiring against us, saying he was mentally ill. It had to stop. She said, you know, she even offered me money, but she wanted rid of me seriously, and my family had stopped me seeing him. So. This is the traumatic bit. When I was 16, in 86, around October, around the time I was starting college, which I couldn't concentrate on because of, I'd actually planned my life around being with this person, so I hadn't any interest in education. He asked me to babysit, and I came round to the house, and there was supposed to be a party over the road at the doctor's house. And she came back in the morning in a rage. He told me to go downstairs. It must have been about 3-4 in the morning. And she came and attacked me with a knife in the kitchen. And this is a bit of a blur because I had post-traumatic stress about this. I was dragged into a car, basically. The car had tinted windows. David's brother was held me down at the side, and I was basically kidnapped. And I had my hands tied with plant fasteners. I had a blindfold tied really tightly around my eyes, so it hurt. And my head was kind of down, and I was just terrified that they were going to kill me. And this person I was seeing was sat at the front next to his wife, and he said, "What are you going to do to her? Are you going to kill her?" Because he didn't seem to know what was happening. And she said, "It wouldn't matter if we did. Nobody cares about her." So I was dragged into this hospital. It looked a bit like my old school, which is mansion house. I was taken up to the door. On the right, there's a big, heavy, heavy wooden door. And this is where the doctor's office is. And as you walk into that room, on the left is some ornaments that were like old medical bottles, antique medical bottles, on the wall on the left. And on the right is a big desk, and behind that was a big bay window. But I was taken through a little bit further and towards the middle of the building, up one flight of steps, and straight ahead, a very small room with not much room, more than a bed. And I was there, and I was anaesthetised. And when I woke up, I tried to run downstairs with some blankets around me to the telephone and call the police. I met up with my abuser later on in life, and I have a recording of him and I talking about this, and me asking him how much money was paid. So this is moving on. That was moving on for about 6 years after all this.
Okay, so tell us, I mean, what was going on there? Why do you think his wife did mm-hmm. this? What was the motivation, and what was she planning?
Well, she had two children, and she wanted him to carry on working. He was one of the top earners in the country. If he'd gone with me, he should have lost everything.
Right, just simply about money, you think? Mm. And whereabouts were you taken, do you know?
The name of the hospital. Well, I've remembered this name through all the traumas and everything, because it was the name of a riding school, a riding stables near where he and I used to meet. And I was very concerned about it, because he was always, his eyes were looking a bit sort of like glazed over, and he was on medication. I didn't like him going to this hospital. So, you know, I made a memory association that the name of the stables was the Grove, and where he was being treated was the Groveland.
What about the police? You say that mm-hmm. you were trying to speak to the police. Did you succeed? Or?
No. This put an end to anything that I would do for the next 2 or 3 years, apart from have a breakdown. All my family moved house straight afterwards. And they concealed everything, saying I was just not well, basically. And then 3 years later, I did have a breakdown, because my grandmother, as I said, had written this letter about being concerned about what was going on at home, had died. So everything had sort of happened, and I just cried all the time. And I was looking for some sort of sense out of it by reading the Bible and reading the Book of Revelations, which I was always a bit of a critical thinker. As I said, I'd had very intelligent mentors my whole life. I was thinking about it critically while also having a breakdown and crying. So the doctors managed to diagnose me in that situation as being paranoid schizophrenia, having that, which is rubbish. And
so how old were you?
I was 19 when I had that breakdown, yeah.
Right. But did you come to the situation again where you felt able to go to the police afterwards about this?
Not for a few years. I was on...
Because, I mean, that's, you know, yeah. being kidnapped, et cetera, is horrific, quite a serious horrific. Thing to happen to you.
I know. I was told by the police when they talked to me and then brushed it aside. It was a heinous crime. Yes, I was 2 or 3 years on medication, on the kind of medication that almost makes you drool and shuffle, and you put on 3 stone in weight in 6 months.
And where were you living?
I was in a temporary mental health hostel at one point, and then I went back to my parents for a few months. And which time I went back to them, I'd actually been told when I had my section overturned that not to go back to my parents because the environment there was too unhealthy. But I did, because I couldn't stand living in a tiny, tiny room, which had been pulled down now, that was unfit to live in, really. So I went back to them, and then, you know, not long after, I was sectioned again. But then the second time I was sectioned in 92, when I was 22, I met my abuser again. He was told by his GP friend to go to this hospital that I was at, and he'd just taken an overdose, and he'd just finished his relationship with his wife and was living separately, and he didn't want, you know. But, and also this GP told his wife my diagnosis, and also came up to us in the hospital. He said something like, making love to a woman is like playing a piano, he said. He was always known for being uncouth. He would talk about patients' details at the dinner table. But you see, the social environment I was in, they had previously been my equals. I never saw any reason why I wouldn't join the similar circles to them. But when they get rid of people, and this person I was involved with said the same, they get rid of you completely. You know, it's completely excluded. And this diagnosis made it much easier for them to manage me.
And I mean, what do you say to people who might be listening to this now and think, well, Maybe she was schizophrenic.
I would have had aspects of a breakdown for certain. Everybody who has a breakdown loses a bit of touch with reality. But I was suffering from post-traumatic stress and the trauma of being abused by abusive family. And I have never had any mental health problems when I'm not being with abusive people. And I was, you know, that's what I would say to them.
And what about your abuser? What about your abuser, Michael, mm-hmm. you called him?
Oh, no, that was his friend. That was my friend in the local neighbourhood. He was he knew him. I'm trying not to name names here. Michael was my friend who lived in this area, the wealthy area, and he took this abuser's dog for a walk. He knew him. So, no, I'm not really happy about seeing his name. The police are hopefully going to do the job and look into this soon.
I mean, obviously, post-Jimmy Savile, they are supposed to be listening to us again, aren't they? But yeah. People who've had these sorts of problems in the past and who've been ignored, like yourself. Have you had any luck with the police more recently?
Not so much... recently, I have waited a month and a half to speak to somebody from the Met, who's actually come back to me at last and is putting my details through to the local people. But the local people have actually done nothing but, lose evidence, lose the fact that I've had an interview with them and basically set me up in the past. So I'm hoping this time round it'll be different.
All right, Rick. Okay. Okay, yeah, because we were talking about that sort of, what would you say if people are, you know, schizophrenia? But now you've answered that, really.
Yeah.
Now, it does sound to me, Sam, like you've kind of run out of options. You've been looking at sort of doctor route. You're finding that you're surrounded by doctors who are complicit in your abuse. You've tried the police. You've got nowhere with them. Where else can you turn? Well, your own family even
exactly,
not helping.
No, and I can't even go to my doctor's surgery who know these people, who've got my diagnosis on the screen every time I come in, and tell them what happened.
So you're kind of isolated, really?
Yes, I am quite isolated.
Also, this chap, tell us a bit more about him. He sounds like an interesting character, very charismatic, your abuser, mm-hmm. and also from Eton, did you say?
That's right, yes, both he and his brother were abusers. Yes, he was very charismatic. He could charm anybody, and he used his power. He knew full well that, you know, he could use his status anyway. He used to joke about it, how people would suck up to him, and including the doctors. And
Now, what about the police? Because I know that you've said that, you know, there was some sort of possibly Masonic connection, because mm-hmm. everybody knows mm-hmm. a lot of the police are Freemasons. Have you got any evidence of the Masonic connection
yes,
here?
Yes, well, definitely. Both my grandfather and my father were Masons, and they were in the lodge in St. Albans. And I used to go to the Christmas dinners, which were very good dress-up events, nice food and everything. And one time we sat opposite the head of police. I don't know whether the right name is head of police,
Chief Constable.
Chief of police, somebody very high up. Locally in the police, that's all I know.
You might have been a chief inspector, who knows? But yeah, but that does. I mean, we've had a case here in Bristol recently where Philip Judd, he was a Freemason, master of a lodge in Weston Supermare. He was also the mayor of Weston Supermare. He was also a Conservative councillor. And his daughter also committed suicide, apparently by pouring petrol on herself in the street. And he was walking the streets for years until. We had a new chief constable a couple of years ago, Nick Gargan, who got him prosecuted. He then did 15 months in jail for having lots of child sex videos, which he'd had, and child sex photographs, that kind of thing. So you get the picture that possibly Freemasonry is connected with a kind of almost an elite who are above prosecution, and it was just by having an honest chief constable in the form of Nick Gargan here in Avon, Somerset for 18 months or so that prosecutions were actually possible.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do believe there's a lot to that, and there was something to do with the palace, somebody being brought into the palace, which brings me to George Smith, who was detained at a Priory hospital by Charles.
Okay, so who's George Smith?
He's
then?
The one who Diana taped inside the Priory, and the tape disappeared, and the Queen brought the trial to an end because it was Burrell who was supposed to have taken them. Then she remembered, oh well, that's okay, I said you could have them.
So this is the same priory, is it?
That, yes, and Charles paid for George Smith to be detained. George Smith was very paranoid that he would be killed, and funnily enough, I shouldn't say funny, it's nothing funny about it at all, it's something that is frightening, but he died in his early mid-40s. Suspicious. No real, I used to drink, but there's no real evidence of what happened.
Have you been able to sort of make sense of this at all, Sam?
Yes, I have. I think with the times we're living in now, there's a lot of us realising that the authorities can do these things and cover things up.
The state is really that corrupt that there isn't justice. There's no recourse for people who are in a, you know, put in the sort of situation that you are. It does. It's a bit. Sounds a little bit almost like sort of Pinochet's fascist Chile or possibly Nazi Germany, Mussolini's Italy.
Well, Paul Robson was given shock treatment at a Priory Hospital, around hundreds of treatments.
Okay, who's Paul Robson?
He was a communist activist in the 60s.
Oh, Paul Robeson.
Robeson.
And so he'd been to the Priory too?
Yeah, he was tortured, basically. Every time he began to recover, they would shock him. And every time he went into depression, they would shock him. And I don't have the exact numbers, but they, in a short period of time, they run into hundreds of shock treatments.
Okay, what do you remember about what happened to you?
I remember some kind of shock treatment, some kind of pain, and being... I don't know what happened to Paul Robson, but it's probably similar. My brain was just depatterned. I was given...
Well, what do you mean by that?
I mean I couldn't concentrate. I had no concentration ability for... For almost 2 years, I was living a dream. My senses were numbed. My personality was stilted.
Okay, and what age were you?
I was 16 to 18.
Okay, so you've got little memory of that time or what?
I was living a bit like Alice in Wonderland. I was really not switched on. You could say I was just, you know, not switched on.
And what do you remember about the process that led to that?
Post-traumatic stress. I couldn't remember the trauma. It was too severe, and that's quite often happens because.
And have you been able to piece it together since?
Absolutely,
well,
yes.
Tell us what you went through to give you that kind of 2 years of switching off from the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a way, it was a good thing that the brain does that because the trauma is so great you can't handle it at the time. If you were to take on that kind of trauma, it would destroy you. So 2 years later, I was starting to have flashbacks, and I went on long, long walks, and this is why they ended up locking me up because I was going on very long walks having flashbacks.
Well, hang on, you are allowed to go on long walks, aren't you?
I think my parents were very controlling. They don't like anything not normal in my family.
Well, it's actually quite normal to go on a long walk.
Very
I think.
Long walks. I went on very long walks.
Okay,
late
how
at
long?
Night, and I used to go driving around in the village where I grew up late at night.
Yeah, okay. So anyway, take us back to this. Yeah. I know it's a traumatic experience, mm-hmm. but take us through it.
Well, I mean, the flashbacks are like something triggers in your mind. You've just got almost like deja vu. You've forgotten something and it just comes back at you. Oh, my God, I've remembered that. That's a link. That's a link, visual, usually, like a flash. And then it goes away. But it's a link to what you've experienced. And you can piece it back together.
But I mean,
it's like flashcards, it's got
to be pretty traumatic to mm-hmm. turn you into Alice in Wonderland for 2 years.
Oh, God, yeah, it was.
What have you managed mm-hmm. to piece together about what happened to you there?
I was lying on a bed with my head going side to side like I've seen people do since who've had ECT. And during that time, I remember images flashing before my mind like it was all the files were being thrown out of a computer screen, basically.
Right, so you think you were actually given electroconvulsive therapy?
Yeah, I remember at one point having a gum shield in my mouth and having a massive headache. So yes, I was indeed.
And what about things like hypnosis? Any memory of that sort of thing?
They talked me through whether I'd go back to the abuser's house, and they talked me through who was your first sexual experience and things like that. And I was remembering.
What is this while electroconvulsive therapy, or while it was happening?
This occasion was when I was lying down in a surgery room about just next, pretty much around the corner and up a few stairs from where the little room was. And yes, they were talking to me and I was afraid of some kind of pain. I couldn't tell you what it was but I do have a scar behind my ear, which my friend Teresa Cooper, who's also been a victim of psychiatric torture, tells me people from a couple of boys from Porton Down had a similar scar.
Okay, so this was done to you where and by whom?
The name of the hospital is the Groveland Priory. And I have strong memories of that place, and it needs investigating. I know somebody else who I met through the psychiatric system who's now pretty much disabled, who was given treatment there and shock treatment there too.
And this is,
and she's had a mother with children. She was perfectly okay before.
This is the same priory you were talking about,
yes,
is it?
Is,
right.
The same
and
one.
And just remind us again exactly where it is.
It's in North London. I don't know the exact address.
Have you been back there?
I've driven back. Yeah, I have once.
Do you sort of go? I mean, because this, I can imagine I would do that.
Yeah,
I would,
it's frightening. Yeah,
it's almost just reassuring yourself that it's real
rather
than.
Yeah, I have. Yes.
An imagination.
Yes, I have.
And you say you've come across other people who mm-hmm. have been there. You mentioned a few there.
There's a woman called Sheila who was given shock treatment at the same hospital, and she is really an invalid and has been, you know, pretty much since the treatment. I met her about 10, 15 years ago. And she was talking about the hospital and the shock treatment. But her partner was abusive, so he'd obviously tried to send her there to sort her out. And then she goes back home to an abusive partner, does, you know, half a brain, you know, probably not good. And, you know, I've known other people who've got diagnoses of schizophrenia who've got abusive families. And one of the diagnostics for paranoid schizophrenia is, are you paranoid about your family? Are they going to get you, sort of thing? And what about if you're being abused by them?
Pretty shocking stuff. You've now pretty much pulled your life back together, haven't
Definitely.
You? You've got some kids and stuff.
Yes, I've got a happy
life. So tell
life
us about that. That sounds a little bit more positive, Sam.
Yes, I've always wanted to have children, and you know that's been something I wanted to secure. A secure sort of happy life, and I found it, like, thankfully I've met the right person at last, and very happy. I've got nothing to gain from actually doing what I'm doing now, apart from the fact that I've got to live with it forever, and I want the public to know what the authorities are capable of doing.
Why?
Because there's a lot of smear campaigns against activists in the child abuse, and calling people, you know, suggesting they have a false memory. And even to the point where people writing for newspapers are talking about the fact that the police are asking people to come forward if they've experienced abuse or know of abuse of a famous person. Some of these people are hell-bent on Twitter and things, you know, journalists and people of saying that even just being asked to come forward is putting a suggestion in people's minds that, like, the public are that stupid, that they can just imagine that they've been abused when they've been asked to, you know, to come forward by the police.
Well, there is the possibility, isn't there, that some people are out there with false stories in order to sort of muddy the waters.
I don't think I've seen any of that. I think it would, if they were, they'd be planted, but I don't think many normal average people would put themselves through that.
So what do you think is the point of all this, if it is quite as widespread as it seems to have been in Britain over decades?
Mm-hmm. I think they keep people segregated, and with the mental health system I've experienced that, so I know full well what people must have suffered in the children's homes and things, because with my family experience, it was almost like an honour killing, except they couldn't do that. So they decided to get rid of me another way and debase me, basically, and discredit me.
Well, so what's the bigger picture? What's the motivation for the people who are doing the abusing?
I don't know. I think sometimes if they've been abused, like public school people, and they think it's normal. I think it's very much people, the stiff upper lip, it's just something you need to get on with at boarding school, isn't it? So we breed a load of elites who have that attitude, and then they're the judges. They let it all go, don't they?
And what do you think will break this oppression ultimately?
I think the institutions need to realise that they're supposed to empower people. They don't just process them. I think that they've almost deliberately kept people under, and the insurance companies, you know, for fear of being prosecuted. People need to be believed, and the stigma needs to go. That will go in time, but people really need to believe. It's not a conspiracy.
And if people want to contact you, can they do that via Twitter or any other way, Sam?
That's,
you know,
right.
People have had a sort of similar experience?
Yes, they can. I'm Sam Hill, 12 12 12 on Twitter. And I'm on YouTube, Sam Hill 1970.
Well, Sam, thanks for bearing your soul to us on Dialect.
It's okay. Nice to be here. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
All right.
Well done, girl.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Joined now by Jules Davis, who's from St Paul's Carnival, at least he used to be from St Paul's Carnival, which there's been lots of news about recently with Bristol City Council, the Mayor, etc., pulling the funding for the existing committee. Now, Jules, give us a bit of background on what your involvement was between 2010 and 2012 as Artistic Director in the Carnival.
Well, my role would have been to work with communities and artists to bring together and animate and articulate that wonderful Caribbean culture to be able to tell the story, but using everything from floats to sound systems to performances, included fringe events, the big stage, the procession, working with schools and education. And it was all about celebrating African Caribbean now, culture.
A lot of us know reggae music. They know Jamaican music particularly as a real inspiration. What was it that was so special about those, the times, maybe the 1960s, around about 70s, etc., where that was producing such brilliant music?
Well, it's very much like the Bristol ethos here about, you know, being different, being unique, being independent, you know, creating something under pressure. I mean, when you think about the Caribbean culture, and, you know, without going too deep into the history of it, but it was the people were very repressed people, and they had to find creative and often very cute and subtle ways to express themselves, and they couldn't do it in front of massa, and they'd find it in their own spaces, and you know, in fact, this is how carnival has come about. You know, many of the cultures, many of the myths, many of the traditions, the celebration itself. And so when they've been in these spaces and not being able to express themselves formally, informally and quietly and discreetly in the background, they've had to find very cute and clever ways to do that. And
so what about breaking through into the mainstream here in Britain? Because I think there was quite a bit of resistance in a way, wasn't there? I mean, to the genuine Jamaica sound.
Well, it's a subculture, and it wasn't quite understood. And, you know, right now we're fast forwarding to the 1960s or 50s and 60s. And again, a distinctive style has started to develop. And because of independence coming around in the 60s, you know, and wanting to celebrate that and shout about it and demonstrate to the world very proudly, loudly, who we are, what we do. You know, for a while it was resisted by the mainstream, but that's how most cult, you know, trends start. It starts with a subculture, and it starts in the basements, it starts in the living rooms, it then transfers to the streets, from the streets into the clubs, onto the radio, building their own mediums. And because it was something that was quite cool and quite edgy and quite anti-establishment, you know, young British youth at the time, teenagers just getting past the war, have also bought into this ethos, because, you know, that teenage exploration, coming of age, identifying with some of the things that these young black youth were going through. You know, it's anti-establishment, it's cool, it's my mum and dad don't like it, so I love it too. And so it's also new,
okay,
and
so
exciting.
But it's anti-establishment, it's pro what?
Well, it's pro people. It's just pro who you are. And when I say anti-establishment, you know, Radio 1 had the same problems at the time. You know, we have to talk about youth culture and look back at what was happening with youth culture just after the war. You know, it's this sudden sense of freedom and this sudden sense of exploration and colour and resources that you didn't have before. And you could say things and do things that would shock mum and dad, looking at the punk culture very closely related to the reggae culture. Again, anti-establishment.
So what's happened, though, to St Paul's Carnival? And a lot of us love Carnival. Some people don't like it, but some St Paul's residents even don't like it because it's just too much hassle, too much noise. But so what's happened in the last couple of years? I'm not even sure which years it was that it hasn't happened. Why is it not happening? Because this is something we looked forward to summer after summer.
I'm like you, you know, actually, for me, carnival's in my DNA. In fact, my parents met at the carnival, and if it wasn't for carnival, I wouldn't be here. So for me, carnival's in my DNA, so I love it. It's like, it's my Christmas, and it's our Christmas. But to go back to your question about why has it not happened, that's a really big question. It's deep, it's wide, and we haven't got enough time. But let me give you a quick history, as I understand it. And I'm just going to go back a decade, but it goes much further than that. And a decade ago, in 2006, the carnival was approaching its 40th anniversary. And as a result, it was going through a structural problem. There were issues with it. The council and the funders at the time said, right, this is not sustainable. Something needs to happen. It was postponed and restructured. The new board came on board. A new structure was put in place. And St. Paul's African Caribbean Limited was the new delivery vehicle for that. And it received a certain amount of funding and commitment commitment from, you know, the funders, so on and so forth. Now, just to look what's happened in the last 10 years, Tony, the fact is 3 out of 10 times St. Paul's Carnival has not happened. That's in 2007, 2012, and more recently, 2015.
Okay, so is that because licenses haven't been granted for it, or what?
It's a myriad of reasons, and it's really not that simple. In different years, it's been attributed to different things. It's been attributed to funding and not enough money being raised in 2012. This year, it's been attributed to not being able to get the right event management in place. So going back to your point about licenses, in 2007, it was a different issue again. But what it boils down to is a number, going back to this myriad of issues, is about infrastructure, it's about leadership, it's about vision, it's about communication, it's about resources, it's about capacity, it's about a whole range of issues that it's things aren't right. Now, the carnival happens. It's a wonderful, wondrous thing, but it's amazing how it happens year in, year out under the current system that it's been, you know, some people say,
isn't it even better to have a few floats and a few bands rather than nothing?
I don't agree, and I don't see it that way personally. And I certainly know if you, you know, go across the road here into St. Paul's, you'll find different opinions on this. But certainly my thoughts are, and one of the reasons why I resigned in 2012 is because there was a suggestion to actually turn St. Paul's Carnival into a light event where it would be basically in Portland Square, finish at 6 o'clock. Be procession led, and in the evening it would be moved off the streets into the nightclubs. Now, like myself and a lot of people felt, that did not reflect to do justice to St. Paul's Carnival. Plus, it would easily be the beginning of the end of what we understand and know is and celebrated for the past 40 years as Carnival. So is it better for something to happen than not at all? I don't necessarily see it that way. I think what is important is that we have the right structure, the right people, the right vision, and the right resourcing in place in order for it to happen.
Now, there's one big, big elephant floating around this decision not to continue to fund the existing committee, and that is that the mayor happens to be a former merchant venturer, a former slave trader.
Well, I think that's I can't possibly comment on that, but you know, certainly my thoughts are George Ferguson and the Arts Council have said, you know, if you read the press release, they've said that they've taken a very close look at what's been happening with the carnival. And, you know, in their statement, they've talked about the last couple of years, a carnival not happening, and they're being funded to make a carnival happen. Now, we have to be realistic and honest here. I'm putting politics aside. I don't want to politicize what carnival is or personalize what carnival is. I think the reality is that carnival is the most wondrous event and so uniquely special, not just to the city, not just to the region, but also to the country. There aren't many events that does what it does. And I really do feel that, you know, who for whatever reason, there is some uncomfortable truths here. And those uncomfortable truths is that things are not right structurally with St. Paul's Carnival. Now, somebody's made a hard and tough decision. The reasons behind it, we'd love to find out.
I suppose
why.
The big question is, when's it going to happen next? When are we going to see it again? Well, because everyone wants it back, don't they?
Tony, if it was up to me, you know it would definitely happen in 2016. However, the word on the street is that it's very unlikely to happen in 2016 because, you know, you mentioned that the funding has been taken away from the committee. It's been ring fenced for St. Paul's. So there's a difference here between St. Paul's the event and St. Paul's African Caribbean Carnival the Limited. And we need to distinguish between that. And so if it was up to me, it absolutely would return. But I really want to see whatever comes back. It comes back stronger. It comes back smarter. It comes back with a clear vision of growth and understanding that it needs to be fully, fully immersive and embrace many, many different communities and evolve. It really needs to evolve so that it can raise the revenue it needs to so that it can be excellently managed, so that it can generate jobs, so that the money could be circulated in our local economy and stay.
Is it going to be a pay event? People have to pay to come?
Well, there might be some really hard conversations for us to have, and that might be what
that means. Security, doesn't it? Well, security everywhere.
It might mean there's already
the whole
security
fences
there.
Fences around.
That's already happened. That's already happening. We're not talking about turning this into a mini Beirut, because within the carnival's current articles, it must stay free, but that's in the current articles. Now, what goes forward in the future, that might be looked at. That might be, look, can I just raise a really important issue? 100,000 people attend St. Paul's Carnival. They raise £5,000, and that's a good carnival by raising £5,000.
This is bucket shaking, yeah?
Bucket shaking, that's personal donations. In reality, that's 20p per head. But let's flip the script there, Tony, because at the same time, it's resourced by the authorities to the tune of £147,000.
Well, that's not too much, is it, out of our council tax?
That's £1.47. You mentioned it yourself. That's £1.47 per head. Now, is that really enough to put on an artistically excellent, internationally renowned event that's safe?
Should it be a profit-making event? Or should it be paid for by the city council out of our council tax?
What I think is that 100,000 people come, they spend £66 per head. That's nearly £7 million that's coming into Erin that day. And I say we do need to be able to monetize enough so that you can draw down enough money that goes back into the carnival itself so that it's self-sustaining. We have to be realistic. You know, 40% cuts are on their way. You know, if you're a weak looking organization, you're going to get your head chopped off. St. Paul's Carnival falls into that because it's a high profile event that's a black led organization which is dysfunctional. That's the reputation that it has. It's infighting and outfighting. It's a problem every year. There's health and safety issues. People are getting stabbed. That's how the media plays it, you know. But just to say, going back to your thoughts around George Ferguson, is what he's specifically said is that he has ring-fenced the money for an African Caribbean-led event. And that's what people, the community, must hold him and the authorities to. They have said they are committed to St. Paul's Carnival. They've just taken the money away from St. Paul's African Caribbean Limited.
Okay, Jules Davis, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Thank you very much, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Joined by Nick Shipton and Helen Green, who are both from Bristol's Palestine Solidarity Campaign. They've just come back from Palestine. Nick, can you just tell us about the organisation that you went over to Palestine with? Who arranged the trip?
Well, the two women have been doing this for about 13 years now. They go to two or three villages in the West Bank occupied territory just south of Nablus, and we stay in villages and help the farmers pick olives. And the purpose being to keep some distance between the settlers. Local settlements are trying to stop the olive harvest, and they get police support unless we're in the way, because then the police have to protect us.
Now, tell us a bit about these settlers. I know Helen, you met some, or I don't know about meeting them, but you certainly had an encounter with some.
Yes, it was my third day actually picking, and we were on a terrace quite near to the settlement of Yitzhar. And settlers had, before we'd arrived, they'd come down and burnt olive trees and attacked farmers.
So am I right in thinking that the point of being there to help with the picking is to sort of witness, really, what the attacks on Palestinians?
And also to try and dissuade them from attacking. You know, we hoped that international people being there would sort of discourage them from attacking, but unfortunately they still did attack us.
Okay, so in what way, and tell us a bit about these people, because they've kind of been moved in, haven't they? And I noticed just this week we've had another announcement quietly in the middle of all this stuff to do with the Paris attacks of more settlements being arranged by the Israeli government.
Well, this the particular settlements near the village I was picking olive in, Burin. There was Yitza and Baraka, and both of them are they're quite renowned for having settlers who do tend to attack the Palestinians.
So, I mean, were you nervous going over there?
Yeah, I was to begin with, but it was something that I felt strongly about. You know, this, you know, it was frightening for us, but this is something that the Palestinians face all the time.
Okay, so what actually happened to you? What were the settlers up to?
Well, I was picking with two other British people and a Palestinian farmer. We were quite close to the settlement of Yitza, so it was on terraced land, and we saw about 10:15 in the morning, and we saw two settlers on the terrace above us. So we took photos of them and we noted it down in notebooks. We thought, you know, this might discourage them from going any further. So then we carried on picking. Then we noticed another settler coming out to the side of them, and he was masked up. He had a scarf wrapped all around his face. And then we saw another one coming out the other side. So we thought, and we couldn't, because it was a terrace above us, we didn't know how many more there were behind them. But we thought, it looks like if they're masked up, they're probably going to attack us. So we decided to start packing everything up. And the farmer who was with us went just slightly to the right, because there were some other people picking further down the hill from us, and he wanted to call for help. At that time, we could see there were quite a few settlers above us, and they were shouting, and somebody answered them from further down the hill on the left. So we realised that there were more settlers down there. Then just after that, we heard a couple of gunshots coming from that direction. So we thought, you know, that we were being fired at. So we lay down on the ground under the olive trees. And then we realised that the settlers who were above us had started coming down the hill towards us. So me and the other woman, Jenny, we got off our feet. And as they were coming towards us, I was shouting, we're British, hoping that would stop them attacking us. They threw some rocks at us. Luckily didn't hit. But David hadn't actually got up onto his feet. He was still sitting. And one of the settlers came up to him with a rock about the size of a grapefruit and threw it at his head, and then did this three times, and then started kicking him in the back with and other settlers were joining in. They took his phone off him, and there must have been about eight of them, all young and masked up, and they were sort of preventing me and Jenny from getting to David. I think Jenny was shouting for them to stop, and she had a camera around her neck and a phone in her hand. So they grabbed a camera and a phone, and then they grabbed her bag. David had managed to get up, so we were going, we'll go. But I was saying, which way should we go? Because we'd heard the gunshot from the left, so we thought if we went that way, we could...
Maybe not that way. Yeah.
So I was going, which way? And they were just going, go. So, and then they kicked in the water canteen as well. So we're thinking, well, we better go. So we were on a terrace, and we climbed down the wall onto the next terrace and started walking down the hill. And then we noticed that there were settlers all around us, and as they were coming down the hill, they were setting fire to the olive trees.
So how many settlers altogether do you think?
It must have been about 30 or more. I mean, the ones who came down and attacked us and threw the rocks at David, there was about eight or nine
now,
of them.
You know, I don't know if I've ever heard settlers talked about as terrorists, but that's what they were doing, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. I mean, getting a rock the size they did and throwing it three times at David's head was, it was attempted murder, really. It could have killed him. Luckily, it didn't, but it could have.
How do you make sense, Helen, of what you saw there? I mean, it's not easy, is it? It's the sort of thing, I suppose, which Maybe people in Northern Ireland experienced the Irish when the settlers were brought over from Scotland to after Cromwell to settle in Ireland.
I think there's a lot of indoctrination goes on in the settlements, and a lot of there's a lot of religious extremists in particularly in that settlement. So I think you know that they seem to believe.
Is that religious, really? I mean, what you say, okay, sorry, carry on. Yeah, what do they believe? What drives them to do this?
They believe that it's the promised land for the Jewish people and that the Palestinians should just not be there.
So really they are kind of fundamentalists, aren't they? Yeah. We don't often hear about the Israelis talked about as fundamentalists either. Nick, tell us a bit about your experience. Did you have anything quite so traumatic happen to you?
I was on the same... AIM, so I was in a different village. We didn't get hit by rocks, but we did have a lot of hassling from the local military and from settlers. To me, the most shocking part of my trip was arriving in East Jerusalem my very first night. I got to Tel Aviv about midnight, so I went on a bus to Jerusalem and go through the Damascus Gate into the Arab Quarter, which is where I've been before, and that's where my hotel was. And in one of the streets, there were armed soldiers and riot barricades. So I had to sort of push my way past these people. And then there's a house right in the middle of the Arab Quarter, which for a long time has had a large Israeli flag hanging from it. It was owned by Sharon, one of the Israeli politicians. But this time, we're talking almost exactly a month ago, there were about 20 or 30 Israelis sitting outside this house on the street. The barricade made sure that the street was about three quarters covered with these people. There's a little narrow alleyway for me to go through. Soldiers supported, probably about 30 soldiers standing guarding them. Any Arabs could not go through. Of course, during the daytime, no Arab shops could open. So effectively, they'd taken over that street. I was allowed through because I'm white and old-looking and harmless-looking. So I went to my hotel. The hotel concierge had stayed up for me. He knew he couldn't get through there, so he had to stay that night. And that was the day that the random, as it says in newspapers, the stabbings began and the attacks of the Palestinians on Israeli soldiers. Unprovoked, according to the newspapers. But to me, that was the deepest provocation I could imagine. I was extremely angry that night and I could hardly sleep.
Well, I mean, it's not a provocation for stabbing, surely. Just having soldiers in the street or whatever, you know, that's not enough, is it?
I don't know. I don't think I would have stabbed anybody, but I was just about the angriest I've ever been when I got to bed at 2 o'clock that night and I could hardly sleep. But... No, it's not provocation and it's not justified, but these Palestinians have lived under just constant niggly, endless pushing. And this time they'd gone and taken a complete street out of the Arab Quarter, about half a mile away from Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is, that'd been in the news before, that the Israeli police had been in the Al-Aqsa Mosque, sending tear gas grenades onto the worshippers.
Now, you talk about the Arab Quarter. Am I right in thinking that East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem are pretty much divided into Jewish and Arab sectors, or what?
West Jerusalem is part of Israel, according to the 1948 agreement. East Jerusalem, not. East Jerusalem was taken over by the Israelis after the 1967 war, so it's part of the Israeli occupation of Palestine. But traditionally, for I don't know how many, 800 years, East Jerusalem is the walled city, which has an Arab quarter, an Armenian quarter, a Jewish quarter, and a Christian quarter. And until this year, going into the Arab quarter, the shops are open. It's like an Arab bazaar. It's a souk. The police had a low level presence there. But on this occasion, one of the streets in that area has been totally taken over by a group of Arab fundamentalist settlers, whatever, terrorists, whatever word you want to call them, and is now no longer usable by people who live there.
Don't the British have a bit of a specific responsibility towards that part of the world? Because, I mean, we you know, people would argue anyway that we handed it over to the Israeli state, who effectively at the time were a bunch of terrorists.
We did. The Balfour Declaration of 1916, I believe, said that the Israeli people, the Jewish people, have a right to their homeland. So it sort of promised that land to them. And from then on, the Zionists had planned quite meticulously how to take over when they could. And when it happened in 1948, they took over what is now Israel and effectively dispossessed the Arabs of huge numbers. Well, large numbers of dispossessed of their lives, but a lot of them are dispossessed of their properties.
I mean, it's all the British's fault, isn't it?
I think we have a lot to answer for, certainly, but the situation now needs to be this responsibility of the people that who are there now.
But I mean, as a Brits yourself, both of you, I'll ask you first, Nick, and then you, Helen. What should be done?
To some extent, I think we need to uphold international law. There is the Geneva Convention that says how occupied territories should be administered.
And I'm not sure if I'm right, but I think over the last few weeks there have been calls for the United Nations to get troops into East Jerusalem.
I had not heard that before, but it sounds as it ought to happen. But I don't think the Americans or the Brits are going to vote for
it. It's the old veto.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you mentioned the 67 war, the Six-Day War, which is when most of this territory that was Palestinian was taken over by the Israeli state. Then there was, I think it was 1973, the October War, the Yom Kippur War.
The Intifada.
Well, which is where the Arab states attacked Israel. Israel fought back very much, very vociferously, with a lot of support from the Americans.
Yeah.
But we're in a situation now with an Israel that feels that it's got to have this as a kind of buffer against its own survival.
That's the story they tell themselves and their people, that they're surrounded by enemy territory and they've got to buffer themselves. But the way they're doing it is certainly not in anything relating to international law or the behaviour that they seem to want to uphold.
Helen, what are your thoughts about British responsibility for all this and whether there is a solution that you can see?
I think what I could see actually happening there is that there's just a gradual encroachment by the settlements. So it's like Palestine is just gradually disappearing, and they'll have an exclusion zone around the settlement because it's unsafe to have.
But I mean, surely in any normal state, when someone throws a rock on someone's head, that person should be arrested and jailed for it.
Well,
but that wasn't happening.
No, it wasn't. What happened with David was he reported it to the Israeli police, and I had photos of the two settlers who we originally saw who weren't masked up and never came down with the other settlers. One of them had a red beard, so he was quite distinctive. We did meet up with some of the rabbis for human rights, and they recognised him as one of the settler security. So this man was known to the Israeli police, and yet nothing is done about it. It just seems like the Israeli police just do nothing about
the
settler attacks.
Well, they've got a culture of impunity.
Yeah.
People talk about racism, apartheid. Is that fair? I mean, we saw that in South Africa very clearly in the 1980s before. But what about in Israel?
Definitely. I mean, I was spent a couple of days in Jerusalem after I finished picking, and you just saw the way that anybody who looked Arab was treated. It was. I mean, I was fine. I could walk around Jerusalem without any problems, but there was Israeli soldiers everywhere, and they were harassing all the Palestinians. And I went to a trip to Bethlehem. So on the way out of Bethlehem, they stopped the coach, and everybody had their passports checked. So there was an old couple on the bus who didn't have to get off the bus. And then I was with another woman, another British woman, so we didn't have to get off the bus. Two armed Israeli soldiers got on the bus to check our passports, and all the other Palestinians had to get off the bus. I didn't really notice what was going on, but after we'd had our passports checked, I looked out the window and they'd penned in just one Palestinian guy. I don't know why they'd chosen him, but he was in a little pen with two Israeli soldiers pointing machine guns at him. And they were searching him, they were frisking him, but then that wasn't enough, so he had to lift up his jumper. And then that wasn't enough, he had to lift up the legs of his jeans, all the time with these two Israeli soldiers pointing machine guns at him. Eventually they kind of decided they'd searched him enough and let him go. So as he sort of walked towards the coach, they were kind of jostling him, and all like about five Israeli soldiers, all fully armed with machine guns, and he had to just keep a straight face and get on the bus. And you just think that is what Palestinian people suffer all the time.
My understanding of apartheid in South Africa was separating the whites and the blacks, but I don't remember hearing sort of degradation and quite so much bullying of the black population in South Africa. I'm sure it went on, but it feels my time in Palestine is how much of the army units are there to just gradually provoke and gradually annoy and irritate. The days that I was olive picking, a day didn't go by without some soldiers coming along and telling us we had to move or we shouldn't be there. But because we were foreigners, we were not subject to their law, so we didn't have to move the way they told us to.
It almost sounds to me like the days of the pirates or something, where you've got completely lawless areas where gangs are running things and there isn't any kind of idea of equitable justice.
I wouldn't say it was like that, but it would be like pirates with the British Navy standing around making sure that nobody stopped the pirates doing what they were doing, so that they've got military support with them.
Now, Helen, you obviously, it was quite a traumatic experience for you. Would you go again?
Definitely. I think what I thought was, I was there for 2 weeks, and then I came back to Britain, and you know, I don't have to suffer anymore. But all the Palestinian farmers, they suffer this all the time, and we were picking with families, you know, with small children, and you know, for families to have to, you know, put up with this, you know, being frightened of those sort of attacks, it's just really unfair on them.
And what about what's going on here in Bristol? Palestine Solidarity Campaign, is it active? Does it meet reasonably often?
We have a monthly meeting, and then any campaigns that are going, we get involved. There was a campaign against Veolia, who at that time had a contract with the Israeli government to make a railway, an Israeli-only railway in Jerusalem.
Wasn't there also recently a news story, I seem to remember, about British security doing something for the Israeli jails or something?
Yes, I'm not sure that particular one, but there was a Hewlett-Packard campaign, because Hewlett-Packard are, again, one of they supply a lot of the Secret Service and the Israeli forces with
I know G4S, I think, were involved as well in the Israeli prison system. Yeah. And the Department of Justice were, I think, just pulled a contract which was to do with the Israeli justice system. Because obviously, you know, you don't want to be supporting a justice system that's an apartheid justice system that allows settlers to come and smash people over the head with rocks and then just turns a blind eye.
We don't, but sadly our government seemed to be rather blind in that direction. And the American government too, so they get a lot of support.
Why is that, do you think?
A lot of arms sales goes towards Israel. I'm sure that armament has a lot to do with it. I can see that the West think of Israel as a buffer against the Iranians and maybe the Iraqis, and so that they're using Israel as a useful tool in there. Geopolitical thinking.
So if people are interested in meeting up with the Palestine support groups here in Bristol, where can they go?
Go online for Bristol PSC. The meeting we have is in Hydra Bookshop on the last Tuesday of every month. So 7:30, you can turn up there and meet people.
That's in Old Market?
Old Market, yeah.
And what sort of things do you talk about? You just have tea or olives or what?
We have tea and olives, true, but... yes, we tend to have events each month of some sort. There's film shows every Monday,
yeah,
and I say, if there's any campaign going on at the moment, boycott, divest, BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign has been going on for quite a long time, and we keep working with that.
I'll just finish with you, Helen. Why does this matter?
Well, it's the injustice of it, really, that seeing like how small the West Bank is and how it's being encroached. And Gaza, you know, you just can't, we couldn't even go into Gaza. You just feel that if this keeps going on, Palestine just won't exist.
Now, I'm no anthropologist, but you talked about a guy with a red beard. It sounds to me like he's not necessarily from that part of the world, and yet he's saying to the people who are, you've got to leave.
Well, there's a lot of Jewish people from other parts of the world coming into Israel. A lot of the settlers are from other parts of the world. There's a lot of American settlers.
Russians,
yeah.
It seems strange that they're saying it's their land.
Yeah.
Why? Why is it, Nick?
There's a wonderful bookmark that I've got produced by a printer in Jerusalem, and it's there's an American saying, "I think I'm Hyman, and my I think Jerusalem belongs to me." And there's a Russian who says, "I'm Boris, and I think Jerusalem belongs to me." And there's eight of them, and it goes right down. There's an Eskimo, "I think Jerusalem belongs to me." And the last picture is, "My name's Mohammed. I thought Jerusalem belonged to me."
So why the focus on Jerusalem, do you think?
Well, Jerusalem's been a religious centre for thousands of years, isn't it? So it's a centre, a very holy centre for the Muslims, for the Christians, and for the Jews. So for that reason, it's been fought over for millennia, hasn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it's a dilemma, isn't it? Because if you're actually a religious person, you probably wouldn't want to fight for it. And it seems like the tough guy is going to take it over.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, thanks both of you, Nick Shipton and Helen Green, for joining us on Dialect today.
Okay, thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect is Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans over the years, currently suspended from Bristol Community FM by the manager and by the chair. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, child abuse survivor Sam Hill, also Jules Davis, one-time cultural director of St Paul's Carnival, and to Nick Shipton and Helen Green from Bristol Palestine Solidarity Campaign, also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko and Rick Margetts. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. And I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till same time next week. Goodbye for now.